Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Science Podcast. I'm producer Giselle Grayson.
And I'm editor Alison Richards. This is where we bring you the highlights of NPR's recent coverage of science. And this week, we have an ancient whale that ate other whales.
An airplane that flies with a giant hole in the fuselage.
A test that may predict our longevity. And to start with, how about this? Does playing Mozart to your babies make them smarter?
That's a good question. Did you play it for your daughter?
Well, I did, but it's hard to tell whether it made any difference. I mean, she was destined to be a genius anyway.
Same here. And while my kids love Mozart, they're also huge fans of Lady Gaga these days. And it turns out that's okay. The Mozart effect is a great example of how scientific research can be misinterpreted. NPR's Elise Spiegel spoke with a woman who did the original research, and here's what she found out.
It all started with this sound. In the spring of 1993, psychologist Francis Rauscher played 10 minutes of a Mozart sonata for 36 college students, then gave them a test of their spatial reasoning. She also had the students take the test after listening to 10 minutes of silence and 10 minutes of a relaxing voice. And the results of this experiment, says Rauscher, seemed pretty clear.
And what we found was that the students who had listened to the Mozart sonata scored significantly higher on the spatial temporal task.
Now, Rauscher emphasizes that the test measured only a certain kind of spatial intelligence, and that's all.
It's very important to note that we did not find effects for general intelligence, just for this one aspect of intelligence. It's a small gain, and it doesn't last very long.
In fact, the so-called Mozart effect lasted only 10 to 15 minutes, which is what Rauscher wrote in the single-page paper that she subsequently published in the journal Nature. And personally, Rauscher didn't expect many people to be interested in this finding. Then came the call.
The first call came from Associated Press before I even knew the paper was coming out. And then, all of a sudden, once it broke in Associated Press, it was everywhere. I mean, we had people coming to our house and interviewing us for live television. I had to hire somebody to handle all the calls that were coming in.
Now, the headlines were less subtle than her findings. Mozart makes you smart was the idea. For some reason, this notion completely gripped the American imagination.
I mean, we walked into Virgin Records one day, and there was this whole kiosk of Mozart music and quotations from our paper.
And then, Rauscher says, things started to go south. For instance, she got misquoted by a TV program, which made her seem like she was saying rock music wasn't cognitively good.
When that happened, I started getting phone calls, literally death threats, from people that were so offended that I would say that rock music was bad for the brain, so I had to get an unlisted number. It was crazy.
But worse, Rauscher says, was that her very modest finding started to really be wildly distorted.
Somehow or other, the myth started exploding that children that listen to classical music from a young age will do better on the SAT, they'll score better on intelligence tests in general, and so forth.
In fact, after hearing about the research, in 1998, Georgia's then-governor, Zell Miller, decided to distribute free classical music CDs to every baby born in the state of Georgia. Tennessee did the same. And eventually, a small cottage industry of Mozart CDs for toddlers and babies sprung up. So why is it that all of this came from such a modest study? Rauscher thinks it's probably a couple of things. Americans believe in self-improvement, but also quick fixes. And she says parents care desperately about their children.
I mean, they want to do everything they possibly can for their children. And if there's the possibility that this might help in some way, that's what they're going to do.
Now, Rauscher still stands by her original finding, but says subsequent research shows it's not really about Mozart. Any music that you find engaging will do the same, basically because it stimulates you.
I think the key to it is you have to enjoy the music. If you love Pearl Jam, you're going to find a Pearl Jam effect.
Britney Spears?
I don't know. Maybe.
The Christina Aguilera effect.
I like the Ella Fitzgerald effect.
And with that in mind, here's something to make all you public radio listeners much smarter for the next 10 minutes. Britney, take us out. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
So, Mozart and the Mozart effect are dead.
So maybe that means we can go back to some of those old nursery rhymes. You know, thinking about the next story reminded me of one of those. I don't even know if you have it over here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, once I caught a fish alive.
I thought the fish in the next story was dead.
Well, yes, it is. It's a shame, though, because when it was alive, it was huge. Because fossil hunters from Europe have discovered one of the biggest predators yet, a whale. It ate other whales and probably everything else in its path. NPR Christopher Joyce spoke to the scientist who discovered this ancient creature named Leviathan.
Leviathan melvillei, to be exact. Leviathan means sea monster, and melvillei refers, of course, to Herman Melville, who wrote the greatest of whale stories, Moby Dick. Among those who've read that book is paleontologist Olivier Lambert.
Yeah, several times. I love the book, so it was the reason why we selected that species name.
Lambert is with the Royal Institute of Natural Sciences in Belgium. He's a modern-day Ahab, though what he's after are the whitened bones of extinct whales. 2 years ago, in a Peruvian desert, his team found some from a sperm whale that lived and died some 12 to 13 million years ago when the desert was underwater. But this wasn't the kind of gentle giant we know nowadays. Our sperm whales have tiny teeth and feed by sucking squid into their capacious mouths. Most other whales don't have teeth at all and filter feed on plankton or shrimp-like krill. But Leviathan had an astonishing set of choppers.
These are probably the largest teeth that I have ever seen. The maximum length of some of the teeth is 36 centimeters.
That would be about 15 inches long and 4 to 5 inches wide at the base.
It looks like an elephant tusk. It's really big.
The mouth was about 9 feet long and up to 7 feet wide. The upper and lower teeth interlocked when the mouth closed, good for securing prey and ripping through flesh. And the skull suggests very powerful biting muscles, thus the giant bite in the title of the research paper, which appears in the journal Nature. At over 50 feet in length, Leviathan probably ate anything it wanted to, but other whales, the toothless kind, were probably its main prey. Lambert says scientists had found big teeth like these before and suspected a toothy predatory whale once existed, but skeletal evidence had been elusive.
We were just amazed by this specimen. It was a very exciting moment because we knew about the existence of very large sperm whales, but no skull has ever been found.
Now that it has, at least the jaws and teeth, it's clearer than ever that the ocean 13 million years ago was a hopping place, and Leviathan would not have been alone.
You have the ancestors of the killer whales, and we could imagine that there was some competition between the two groups.
Not to mention Megalodon, the biggest shark that ever lived. Leviathan would have been the heavyweight in this crowd of top predators. No doubt he'll soon be terrorizing moviegoers at your local multiplex cinema. Steven Spielberg, are you on this? Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
And now we go from ocean depths to almost outer space. John Hamilton reports this week on a NASA effort to study the stars from an old Pan Am jet.
Most telescopes are either fixed to the Earth or stuck in orbit, like the Hubble Space Telescope. The one aboard SOFIA operates somewhere in between, at about 40,000 feet. It does this by peering out through a car-sized hole in the fuselage of a 747 as the plane flies through the stratosphere. Scientists think this novel approach to astronomy will help them to answer some cosmic questions. Eric Beckland from UCLA is the project's chief science advisor. He says scientists already know that stars and planets begin as scattered particles in space.
What we don't know is when do stars like the Sun form? Do they form just out all by themselves and then an Earth forms out there? Or do they form in clusters? These are the kind of answers that we want to get to. But to do that, we have to go to the very earliest time that stars are forming, and that's what SOFIA can do.
SOFIA sees these infant stars by detecting infrared radiation, heat, rather than visible light. Infrared telescopes don't work very well on the ground because moisture in the atmosphere absorbs the radiation. But Beckland says at 40,000 feet, there is almost no moisture left.
We can actually fly up to a region where it really clears up. So it's kind of like being a cloudy day down here, and all of a sudden it's clear, and you can do that with an airplane. And that's why SOFIA is so special.
Of course, infrared telescopes in space stay above all the moisture, but they have short lives and can't be tweaked or fixed once they're in orbit. SOFIA is designed to fly for 20 years, and it can be modified after every flight. That's got scientists pretty excited. But just 4 years ago, Becklin says, the project almost died.
The telescope had been integrated, but we hadn't flown yet. And then all of a sudden, NASA said, we're going to cancel SOFIA.
To understand why SOFIA's future was in doubt, you have to go back to its start 14 years ago. Bob Meyer is the program's manager at Dryden Flight Research Center near Palmdale, California. Meyer says SOFIA always had doubters. Early on, he says, people tended to ask him the same question.
Who would have thought of cutting this big a hole in the back of an airplane? And you know, my response was, NASA takes on challenges like this and takes what appear to other people to be crazy ideas and turns them into reality.
The first step was picking a plane. Meyer says this 747, once part of the old Pan Am fleet, was an obvious choice.
At the time, the 747 was the largest airplane flying, and the telescope was engineered to be as large as it could be and still fit inside a 747.
That turned out to be more than 8 feet across. The plane ended up looking like it had swallowed something very large. There's a noticeable bulge behind the wing. Part of that bulge is a garage-sized door that retracts to give the telescope's mirrors direct access to the night sky. Meyer says the observatory can fly like this for hours.
We're looking at light that was generated, you know, literally hundreds of millions of years ago. So in order to get enough light, it may take an hour of just looking at that target to gather enough light from it to reconstruct the picture.
Skeptics also asked whether a 747 with a big hole in it would fly smoothly enough for cutting-edge astronomy. Troy Asher, a research test pilot for NASA, remembers the first time they opened the door in flight.
Sitting there waiting, and they say, okay, we're going to open the door, and there's a countdown, 3, 2, 1, open. And if you didn't actually pay attention extremely carefully when they say ready, ready now, you would have missed it.
Great engineering. But it all took a lot longer and cost a lot more than it was supposed to. Which is why, after a decade of overruns, NASA was ready to cancel the program. Scientists and the German Aerospace Center, a partner in the project, got the decision reversed, but the reprieve came with huge pressure to finish quickly. So it was a big deal when, a few weeks ago, SOFIA took off and opened its telescope to the skies for the first time. Eric Becklin says the results were better than anyone had expected.
We had images that are the sharpest images that have ever been seen of Jupiter and M82, which is a galaxy, a nearby galaxy, where massive stars are forming.
Becklin says now SOFIA can turn its gaze to distant galaxies, where future stars are still just particles scattered in space. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And that was a fitting story to have this week. It's the 30th anniversary of Airplane. Can you believe it's been 30 years?
I don't think I know the movie.
You don't Airplane. You've got to see it. It's out on Netflix. It's been out for a while.
Well, back to business I do know about. This week, scientists from Boston University are reporting that they've found some genetic indicators that may predict how long we might live. It's a long way from being any kind of test that could tell you when your number might be up, but they are hoping it will lead to a better understanding of the genetics of why some people live longer than others. Here's Joe Palker.
15 years ago, scientists in Boston began the New England Centenarian Study. The criteria for participating? You had to be at least 100 years old.
The oldest subject in our study was 119.
Thomas Pearls is director of the study. Pearls says whatever other factors are involved in living into your hundreds, genes must play a role. Longevity definitely runs in families. But which genes and how they worked was a mystery. So Pearls teamed up with Boston University geneticist Paola Sebastiani.
And left it up to Dr. Sebastiani to solve the genetic puzzle.
Okay, and so Dr. Sebastiani, did you solve it?
I think we went step ahead. Maybe we haven't solved it completely.
Sebastiani took samples from the centenarians and looked for differences between their DNA and the DNA of normal-aged people. As she reports in the journal Science, she was able to develop a computer model that used 150 genetic markers, specific bits of DNA scattered around the 23 pairs of human chromosomes, to predict who would be able to join the centenarian club.
And the accuracy of this model is 77%.
The model also allowed Sebastiani to identify genetic signatures, gene patterns that were present in subgroups of centenarians with particular characteristics. For example, the subgroup who lived the longest was also the group most likely to have delayed onset of diseases that typically affect older people.
For example, dementia, cardiovascular disease, hypertension.
In other words, Sebastiani says not only did these people live long lives, they lived long, healthy lives.
So have you tested yourself for your genetic signature using these markers?
Not yet.
Neither has her colleague Thomas Pearls.
Actually, the various authors of the paper feel that this really isn't quite ready for prime time.
First, the test isn't 100% accurate. But second, what would you do with the information? Okay, maybe you'd do a better job of saving money if you knew you were going to live to 100. But Pearl says consider the flip side. If people knew they were unlikely to live to 100, they might stop watching their weight or exercising, or start doing dangerous things like
jumping out of an airplane and being a real risk taker. Because I'm not going to live a long time versus maybe I shouldn't be such a risk taker.
Pearls and Sebastiani agree that the real value of this study should be what it will tell scientists about the genetics of aging.
At the moment, this is a statistical analysis, and a lot of work has to be done to then understand what is the biology, what's the contribution of all these different genetic markers. So this is the first step.
Geneticist Richard Myers of the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology in Birmingham, Alabama, agrees.
This is sort of the first hint of regions of the genome that might be important for extreme longevity. And it's you have a hint, and that's better than having nothing.
But it does mean understanding the genetics of longevity will take a while, maybe even 100 years, if we live that long. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
And that's it for this week's Science Podcast. I'm producer Giselle Grayson.
Do join us next week when our new series on human evolution, The Human Edge, begins. And in the meantime, take a look at npr.org/science for more work from the Science Desk. Until next time, I'm Alison Richards. Goodbye.